akin to emptying a bucket of water with a thimble. Only the slowly rising mound of dirt and stone under his chin gave any sign of progress. When this mound impeded him, it was time for the basin at his feet. He stretched his arm under his body, rotating at the torso to lengthen his reach. As he moved, the roof and walls littered dirt all over him. He dragged the basin up his side until it lay flat on the base of the tunnel. Completing such a simple task in such a small space was exhausting. Kennard's fear of the walls closing in on him only heightened the strain. After scooping the mound into the basin with his hands, he screwed his body sideways again to push the basin back down to his feet. Then he tugged at its attached rope so his mates knew to haul it out. A moment later, the shallow basin skittered and danced its way into the darkness behind him. He took a brief rest from the strain of maintaining a constant fixed position on his belly, arms out ahead of him, neck craned. He was sweating heavily, his nerves frayed. After he had advanced a little farther, he stopped digging and made a brace for the ceiling and walls. These braces were placed every 3 feet to prevent a collapse. He had brought some planks down with him, nicked from the support boards of the beds in the barracks, and cut to size. The tunnelers had taken so many of these boards that new arrivals to Holzminden often found their beds collapsing under them if they sat down too quickly. First, he wedged a board into the roof. On the floor, he set another of the same length. The third plank he angled between the two horizontals, then knocked with his fist until it stood on the left edge of the tunnel. He did the same on the right. An experienced sapper had found that the oval shape of the tunnel was sufficient to carry the weight of the earth above. Kennard could only pray that their reinforcements would hold. On January 26th, 1918, Jim Bennett stood on the icy parade ground, waiting for morning roll call, when a line of police officers, followed by plain-clothed detectives, marched into the camp. They were from Berlin, Niemeyer informed the men, and they would be conducting a special inspection. All prisoners were to return to their barracks and wait in the corridors by their rooms until called. No one would be allowed back into the yard until the detectives had finished. Searches were common at Holzminden, but a quick rifling through their belongings rarely uncovered their hiding places. Compasses secured in the handles of shaving brushes, maps folded inside book covers, civilian clothes and money concealed in false bottoms or sides of footlockers. This search, however, was something altogether different. Bennett was worried. Although yet to determine a path of escape, he had collected a fairly complete kit. 6 weeks after sending the coded letter to his family about obtaining a photograph of a Rolls-Royce, a parcel arrived containing a badminton bat. He noticed that the leather binding on the handle was slightly loose. On unwrapping it, he spotted a plug cut into the wood. Inside the hollow handle was a rolled map and a small compass, two items critical for any home run to Holland. If these were found by the detectives, he might not have another chance to replace them, and he would most certainly find himself back in solitary confinement. Similar fears pervaded the barracks, especially among the tunnelers. The intensive inspection might uncover the secret door cut into the cellar stairs wall. A mad scramble ensued as prisoners tried to bribe guards with soap and wine to pocket their contraband, or at least to allow them to hide it away for the time being. There were also fake scuffles and a hullabaloo to distract the detectives from their job. One prisoner clapped his hand onto a guard's back, sticking a card to his tunic, chalked with the message, "You know my methods, Watson." As the guard stormed down the corridors, laughter followed him. The detectives went from room to room for hour after hour and uncovered forbidden goods hidden behind beds, underneath floorboards, and on the prisoners themselves. Among the piles of contraband they collected were wire cutters, maps, German money, tinned food, and civilian clothes. While the inspection was underway, prisoners pickpocketed watches, cufflinks, and even a hat from the detectives. They also managed to steal back a few of the sacks of contraband while the Germans were occupied elsewhere. In the evening, they finally came to Bennett's room. He waited out in the corridor, on edge that his cache would be found. Inspired by the false wall built by Gerald Knight to effect his escape from Stroen, Bennett had installed a false beam in his ceiling, camouflaging its seams with the same mixture of cornstarch, dirt, and cobwebs Knight had used. The detectives looked high and low through his room, but missed the unusual appearance of the beam. After 12 hours, the search at Holzminden finally ended, the tunnel undetected. Crowded in their corridors all day, given nothing to eat, the prisoners were miserable and on the verge of rebellion. Niemeyer shut them in for the rest of the night. Although relieved his kit was safe, Bennett was beginning to lose hope that he would find a way to escape the camp. Since the recent death of his eldest brother Robert, who had been an RFC pilot stationed in France, Jim wanted nothing more than to be home with his family. Normal life, as far as that was possible, resumed at Holzminden the next day. One prisoner likened the routine there to the diary entries Mark Twain quipped he kept as a boy. First day, got up, dressed, went to bed. Second day, got up, washed, went to bed. Third day, got up, dressed, went to bed. The rigid schedule of roll calls and meals, long lines, torments by Niemeyer, and early lockdown reinforced this slog, but not all was oppression for those who were open to the possibilities. As January moved into February, Will Harvey found his way to that place of possibility. He realized that surrounding him at Holzminden were a multitude of characters from all over the British Empire. A motley crew, a fellow captive described, Australians, South Africans, Canadians, New Zealanders, Irish, Scotch, English, and Welsh. Every branch of the armed services was there too. Pilots, cavalrymen, infantry, engineers, sappers, and garrison gunners. All manner of conflicting personalities was represented. The intellectuals regard with disdain the flighty scandalmongers. The foxtrot outfit squabbles with the churchgoers, both requiring the same room at the same time for their wildly different purposes. Then there are the drunks and the blue-ribbled army, the studious and the do-nots, the nightbirds and the gamesters. Most of the prisoners had no intention of burrowing a tunnel or concocting an elaborate breakout scheme. They filled their hours in other ways, taking advantage of the small liberties that Niemeyer now allowed them. Some of the men checked books out from the bustling library. Its diligent attendant had collected almost 5,000 volumes. Others joined study circles to discuss architecture or the evolution of mankind. Some took classes taught by other prisoners practiced in farming, construction engineering, bookkeeping, horse management, and town planning, as well as French, Russian, German, and even Portuguese. There were hockey teams knocking about on a half-sized oblong ice pond formed on the Spielplatz, and officers sought to best each other in jiu-jitsu classes. Bridge and poker sessions ran around the clock, often fueled by too much wine, and there was even a knitting circle. Several prisoners became amateur painters and sketch artists. They also formed an orchestra. Some prisoners were professional musicians who wrote and performed original pieces. There was a man there who seemed to be able to play anything, one orchestra member later recalled. He taught me the double bass and trombone. The orchestra kept me going. It kept our spirits up. It would have been terrible if we'd just had to mooch about all day long. Will Harvey loved music and composed a few pieces himself. He gave a lecture on the relations of music and poetry. Such was its popularity that he packed the dining hall with 200 men on 2 consecutive nights. "Nothing has the power of music to lift one out of one's surroundings," he argued, "and to none more poignantly than to prisoners of war does music bring her valiant reminder of things outside the refreshing comfort of a world of realities transcending human chance. The orchestra accompanied the upstart Gaiety Theater, which Niemeyer finally permitted, perhaps in part because it offered his guards free entertainment. A rotating cast of prisoners-turned-actors from the British Amateur Dramatic Society put on variety shows and plays in the dining hall of Block B, pushing together the tables to make a stage. The night after the big search, they ran a sketch comedy called The Touch of Truth. Other productions included Home John, The Just Impediment, The Crimson Streak, and The Pigeon. Besides actors, the theater occupied a small army of prisoners who became practiced stagehands, set designers, costume makers, and directors. James Whale, who would later become famous for his early Hollywood films Frankenstein and The Invisible Man, got his start in drama at Holzminden. Pots of paint, wigs, flats, and all the properties in true bohemian confusion, he wrote. And yet on show nights, they jumped together like magic. Harvey, too, began to savor this magic, and the antics that came from creating it. One of his roommates played some of the female roles in drag, and Harvey found his friend's unusual effect on the other prisoners hilarious. "They insisted on giving up their seat to me," he recounted to Harvey. "It was quite pathetic to see the efforts made to engage my female interests in subjects no sane POW would consider. How pretty the room looked, and the costumes, so picturesque, weren't they? I had to pull them back to reality by swearing vigorously." Only in fleeting moments, since first being captured, had Harvey managed some respite from the green mold of imprisonment. At Schwarmstedt, he had even given a talk on the best way to lessen its terrible toll, namely, the comradeship of men. But it took the worst of Holzminden and his dark time there for him to completely embrace his own advice. Mossy's ceiling sketch, and the humorous poem it inspired, had put him on this path. In friendship and community, Harvey escaped the prison at last, without ever reaching beyond its walls. The arrival in December of Harold Medlicott had bolstered the mood throughout the camp. The officers believed that if anybody could escape Holzminden and humiliate Karl Niemeyer, it was Medlicott. A legend even to the German guards, he had broken out of 9 camps already, never using the same method twice. In his usual bluster, Niemeyer assured Medlicott that Holzminden was escape-proof, a claim that guaranteed any success would be all the sweeter for the camp. On Sunday, February 10th, Medlicott and his partner, Captain Joseph Walter, were ready to go. Their plan was timed to the second. The orderly, Dick Cash, provided the needed wire cutters. He had traded food with a German workman for the tool. Cash was more than willing to take the risk. The week before, Niemeyer had cut off parcel deliveries to the orderlies after accusing them of shirking their duties. At 3:30 p.m., wearing old Burberry jackets, rucksacks looped over their shoulders, Medlicott and Walter emerged from Block B. It was an ordinary afternoon in the camp. Officers warmed their hands around the cookhouse stoves. Some strolled about the Spielplatz. Patrolling guards paced the grounds. Nobody paid the two any mind. In the bright light of day, they made a hard right turn and crossed the gap between the two barracks blocks. Without hesitation, they lifted the single strand of wire that marked no man's land. At the barbed wire fence, a few feet beyond, they bent down and quickly cut a hole. Prisoners spotted the brazen move from the windows of both barracks blocks. At first, they could not quite comprehend what they were seeing. 2 sentries were walking a beat in no man's land behind each block. Surely they would notice them. But the officers had carefully timed their movements. At this point, the sentries were walking away from each other, headed to the western and eastern ends of each barracks block, their backs to the 2 escapees. Once they reached the end of the blocks, however, they would turn around and come back. If they turned early, Medlicott and Walter would be lost. There was the guard who patrolled outside Holzminden's perimeter wall to contend with as well. Still, Medlicott and Walter continued. They were now at the northern wall. Medlicott hoisted his partner up on his shoulders, and Walter snipped a hole in the barbed wire palisade. As soon as the hole was complete, he passed the wire cutters down to Medlicott, pushed through his rucksack, then crawled through after it. Still, no alarm was raised. Medlicott threw the wire cutters back across No Man's Land for Cash to retrieve. Then, just as the two guards made their about-face, he scaled the wall like a spider and dove through the hole in the palisade. No alarm was raised from the sentry posted beyond the perimeter. Outside the wall, Medlicott and Walter calmly stood by the wall, unfolded gentlemanly Homburg hats from inside their jackets, lit cigarettes, and started down the road like two villagers out for a Sunday stroll. What the men didn't know was that a sharp-eyed German guard watching over the isolation cells in Block B had, through a small high window, caught sight of them mounting the wall. By the time the guard ran up the steps into the yard, the two breakout artists had turned off the road and were heading toward a span of woods half a mile away up an incline. They were still within sight of the camp when the alarm was finally raised. At first, they kept to a fast walk, hoping they might yet be mistaken for civilians. When guards poured out of the main gate and headed in their direction, they quickened into a jog. Soldiers from a nearby garrison, alerted by telephone by Niemeyer, cut them off before they reached the woods. When he was brought back to Holzminden to the sound of cheers from the officers, Medlicott looked like a caged animal ready for another break. Niemeyer met him in the yard, flushed with pride. He clapped his hand to the escapees' chests and declared, "All my boys come back to me." When the officers standing in the windows would not be quiet, Niemeyer ordered his guards to fire at the barracks. Nobody was hit, but the crashing glass forced the men to back away. Medlicott and Walter were brought down into the cellars and eventually sent away, not to be seen again at Holzminden. At the next roll call, triumphant at the capture of the great Harold Medlicott, Niemeyer boasted about his unblemished record of no successful home runs to Holland by the prisoners in his charge. But if he thought that the foiled attempt had crushed the morale of any who would dare to be next, he was wrong. As one prisoner wrote to Medlicott's family, the staggeringly brave display only proved to them all that it was impossible for the Germans to confine a determined man. Chapter 15. In late February 1918, the tunnel plot ran into trouble yet again. The sap was some 25 yards long when the men began to encounter roots and flat rocks embedded in hard clay. Progress slowed, and the tunnelers emerged after their shift with cuts to their hands and a brawl's worth of bruises from bumping their arms, legs, and heads against the stones. They suspected they had run into an ancient riverbed. At the same time, their team was falling apart. Since the Boxing Day announcement about prisoners being transferred to internment in Holland, similar declarations came almost weekly. Often these were contradicted the very next day. Names dropped, dates postponed. Mossy, Rogers, Ellis, Cahoon, and a handful of the original tunnelers received word to pack their bags. Rather than welcoming the news, they were devastated. They had spent their time in captivity risking death, suffering solitary confinement, and exhausting themselves, all with an eye on escape. They saw the transfer as failure, especially since, under the terms of the agreement between the Germans and the Allies, released soldiers were forbidden to return to the battlefield. Further, although they would be free from Niemeyer and the trials of Holzminden, they would be leaving their friends behind in Germany, among them Will Harvey, who was being moved to another camp, Bad Kolberg, on account of his bad character. As Cahoon said, "I felt like a deserter, nothing more or less." Given the choice, he would gladly have traded places with someone to remain. At the end of February, Gray said his goodbyes to Cahoon and the Pink Toes. They left the sap in his hands, as the father of the tunnel. Now only Kennard and RNAS observer Frederick Murdoch remained from the original team. Gray would not only need to figure out how to burrow through the layers of rock the men had encountered, but also to recruit a new band of tunnelers to the effort. Picking the right men was essential. They needed to be resilient, cool-headed, brave, and most of all, discreet. Not even their roommates could know about the tunnel, lest word slip to someone who might give them away, either deliberately or inadvertently. Thanks to Hainish sending the most die-hard escape artists to Holzminden, Gray had a long list from which to choose. He entrusted Murdoch, whom he had known since Osnabrück, with the task of sitting down with potential candidates. Quietly, usually at night, over a glass of wine or some treasured brandy, Murdoch held his meetings. Walter Butler and William Langren were both infantry officers who had been captured during the first fighting on the Western Front. They were such troublemakers, they were considered ineligible for transfer to Holland. They were perfect for the team. Next, Murdoch recruited Sub-Lieutenant David Wainwright of the Royal Navy. Wainwright had been on board the HMS Nomad, a British destroyer, on May 31st in 1916, when it was sunk during the Battle of Jutland, the largest sea battle of the war. Time and again he had rankled his captors with his escape schemes. Next was Oxford-educated Neil MacLeod, second lieutenant of the King's Own Scottish Borderers. He had been shot and captured in early 1917, in advance of the Allied offensive at Arras. He'd escaped from other camps twice since then, until being delivered to Holzminden. Lieutenant Arthur Morris, of the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, had also proven tough to keep locked up. Gray then added Robert Pattison and Clifford Robertson. Like Cahoon, they were officers of the Canadian Infantry. They had been caught in April 1917, while trying to take German emplacements during the Battle of Arras. Fellow Canadian, Andrew Clouston was also invited to join the team. His scheme to escape by chute over the Holzminden Wall might have failed, but he had shown his fearlessness. Murdoch also recruited his fellow RNAS pilot, Colin Lawrence. The two shared the same rare experience of having force-landed off the coast of Belgium before being taken ashore by U-boat. Since being captured with Bennett, Lawrence had attempted to escape from several camps. He was one of those who had broken out through the secret panel in Block A, but was captured again after becoming lost in a fog. All told, that made a core group of 12, to which Gray decided to add a supplemental work party of 6 to dig, serve as lookouts, and perform other tasks. The only distinction was who would have priority of escape on the night they decided to use the tunnel. Two of his first selections were both observers, Peter Campbell Martin and Jim Bennett. In early 1918, Campbell Martin was shot down west of Brussels. He escaped from a German encampment in a small village the day he was captured, only to be nabbed 9 days later while trying to make it to Holland. At his first prison camp, he escaped again. Campbell Martin and Gray had much in common. Both were born and raised in India and military educated. Bennett was an obvious choice, not least because Lawrence knew him to be brave and trustworthy. Although his first tunnel at Stroen had been discovered, Bennett was inspired by the bold escape of Medlicott and Walter to try anything. He was known as a hard worker, and, from his ceaseless walks around camp, he was surely in shape for the job. One day in March, Gray was in his barracks room when some of the new team came in, back early from their shift. They explained that they had run into a hunk of sandstone, whose dimensions they could not measure, although it was assuredly too big to break apart and haul through the narrow tunnel. He needed to come take a look. Gray hurried from his room, changed into an orderly outfit, and made his way down into the secret chamber. Lamp in hand, he crawled to the face of the tunnel. Poking at the sandstone confirmed it was too hard to chisel into pieces. He bored holes in the dirt around the rock to see how far it went, but he could not find its edge. There was only one solution. They would have to tunnel around the obstruction, no matter how long it took. The news depressed the men, particularly since they were already engaged in the difficult task of cutting through roots and the compacted riverbed. More work, more time, more risk. Gray asked all of this from them, in no uncertain terms, and they accepted. As one of the tunnelers succinctly said, the turn had to be made, and it was so. Soon after, a new prisoner arrived at Holzminden, Cecil Blaine. Happily and at long last, he was back together with Kennard and Gray. Blaine became a key part of the team. He had spent over 2 months digging a tunnel at Neunkirchen, experience he offered to Gray, who accepted straight away. If they were ever to break free from Holzminden, they needed every practiced hand available. Reports from the Continental Times and smuggled-in newspapers portended that it was unlikely peace would come any time soon. Just before dawn, on March 21, 1918, Operation Michael was launched. Named after the sword-wielding archangel and patron saint of Germany, the offensive involved 6,608 guns and 3,534 trench mortars from German positions southwest of Saint-Quentin in France. Allied lines were hit with such continuous tumult and fury that the whole world seemed to be exploding around them. 5 hours after the barrage of artillery came the call, "Out of the trenches!" 76 elite German divisions hurled themselves on their enemy through dense fog, smoke, and clouds of chlorine and phosgene gas. More than 1,000 planes provided air support. General Erich Ludendorff, the operation's mastermind, mustered 1,386,177 soldiers for the attack. "We will punch a hole in their line," he told his staff. "For the rest, we shall see." With Russia out of the war, he intended to deliver a knockout blow against Britain and France in advance of the Americans joining the fight in great numbers. Put simply, Ludendorff's aim with the crushing offensive was to win the war. Within days, the British Fifth Army was in tatters, and a 50-mile gap had been cleaved into the Allied lines. 200,000 men were dead or wounded, 90,000 had been taken prisoner, and 1,300 guns were lost. There was little but open field ahead of Ludendorff, the heart of France. Wilhelm II sang the praises of his soldiers, showered medals on his generals, and over toasts of champagne promised, "If an English delegation came to sue for peace, it must kneel before the German standard, for it was a question here of a victory of the monarchy over democracy." In the town of Holzminden, bells pealed, and children were let out of school to celebrate. At roll call, guards boasted that "England ist kaputt." Gathering the prisoners for a speech, Niemeyer was no less boastful. "Well, gentlemen, for you the war will soon be over. Germany will rule the world, and you will return to your homes. Our Kaiser has given an order that the flags shall be hoisted, and that we should cheer the German victories." With that, he ordered a lieutenant to raise the flag atop the pole. In conclusion, he said, "Thousands of Germans are going west every day." To his surprise, the prisoners cheered. Going west was a euphemism for a soldier dying. Although the news in the Continental Times was always suspect, on March 25th its headlines were particularly sobering. German offensive, sweeping success. According to the latest news on the front page, a considerable portion of the English army has been defeated. Long-range German artillery was bombarding Paris every quarter of an hour. The British were burning French towns as they retreated. In the Grand Offensive, the paper's editor wrote with faux equivocation, "The victorious verdict is going to be won by the most brilliant leadership and the individual military intelligence of the men." On which side those qualities stand superior, why, we leave it to our readers to judge for themselves. Niemeyer claimed that Germany would win the war in 3 months. But it was a fool's wish to believe he would show some magnanimity to the prisoners until then. He seemed impervious to rebuke. Another inspector came in the spring, this time reporting accurately to the Dutch legation on some of the abuses, but nothing changed. Dozens of former Holzminden prisoners, now interned in Holland, chronicled these abuses in even more scathing terms to Downing Street, but still, nothing changed. Public shaming of the Germans in the Times had no effect, nor did diplomatic calls from Lord Newton to remove Niemeyer and Hainisch from their posts. Reprisals against German POWs in Britain, in the form of limited parole and privileges, also did nothing to alter conditions at German camps. Victory, and its guarantee of not being held accountable for his crimes, only emboldened Niemeyer further, as it did with other camp commandants. Escape fever ran high everywhere, particularly as the influx of Allied prisoners captured during Operation Michael overcrowded the camps. At Schweidnitz, a camp on the eastern edge of Germany, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Rathborn prepared for his breakfast. He fashioned a suit out of a merchant marine uniform. He forged a passport and travel papers, stamping them with a Prussian spread eagle carved into the rubber sole of a tennis shoe. He tracked the movement of the guards and found a moment when only one was watching the wall. A little nighttime boxing match might distract the guard from his duty, Rathborn decided. He had briefly returned to Holzminden after being shipped out in advance of the November 1917 inspection visit. Then he was moved again to Schweidnitz. There, he declined to join two competing tunnel projects because he was sure that one or the other would be discovered. Instead, he aimed to hop the wall, and then, using his fluent German, buy a train ticket to Holland. An army major was in on the plan. One night in late March, while a group of prisoners were boxing in the yard under the arc lamps, Rathborn and his partner climbed over the wall. They walked into town and bought their train tickets. Rathborn even won a smile from the girl in the booking office. They were in a crowded fourth-class carriage, awaiting departure, and confident they were in the clear, when a station guard appeared and began moving through the carriage, checking documents. Rathborn handed over his passport. When asked why he was in Schweidnitz, seeing as his hometown was Leipzig, he rattled off in German that he was a commercial traveler trying to sell some musical instruments. This seemed to satisfy the station guard, who moved on to the major. When the second man stumbled on some responses, the two were asked to leave the train. In a guard room, they learned the reason. The stamps in their passports were wrong. Unlike Schweidnitz, which used the Prussian spread eagle for its stamp, the Leipzig stamp symbol was a lion. On such simple mistakes were the best-laid plans foiled. After a stay in solitary at Schweidnitz, Rathborn was returned to Holzminden. Niemeyer confronted him at the door of his cell in the cellars of Block B and told him that he was back in Holzminden because it was impossible to escape. A short distance from Rathborn's cell, three officers were cutting a path through the earth, aiming to prove Niemeyer wrong. Cecil Blaine was breaking his own promise never to tunnel again. As he clawed the dirt to drag himself forward, the flickering candle cast a devilish dance of shadows about him. Too often as he dug, rats scurried across his back or stared him straight in the eye. Worms and a host of unseen insects crawled through his hair and squirmed underneath his work outfit, which stuck to him like a mildewed second skin. And the air, there was never enough to fill his lungs as he forged his way around the sandstone wall that had slowed the tunneler's progress for weeks. As he advanced, he made sure to limit the swing of his elbows, the kick of his feet, the rise of his back. One indiscreet move in an unlucky spot, and the walls or roof might give in under the weight of the earth above. There would be no warning, no thunder boom to announce the cave-in. The dirt would simply cover him like a heavy shroud, immobilizing his body with its terrible weight, snuffing out his breath before he could cry for help. At Neunkirchen, he had known well the vagaries of tunneling into the earth. That prison, formerly a community center, was unlike any other in which he had been held. They slept in what had been the theater hall, 80 prisoners in double bunk beds, where the venue's seats had once been. The boarded-up stage provided an ideal location to start a sap unseen. After creating a secret entrance underneath the stage, Blaine and several others burrowed through the ground toward the outside wall. They rigged up a Morse code buzzer in the tunnel that would warn the men to lie silent whenever a guard was present in the theater, and built an electrostatic generator called a Wimshurst machine for entertainment, they said, to drown out the sound of their digging. Such was the racket its counter-rotating discs made to generate static electricity that an elephant could have stomped on the stage and nobody would have heard it. With these measures, Blaine and his fellow tunnelers dug for 2 months undetected. It was an awful business. Their sap was always welling with water, and they suffered frequent wall collapses. Fortunately, none was lethal, but the scares left the men on edge. They had almost made it 25 yards, when an inspection rooted them out, and Blaine was sent away with nothing to show for his work. Now at Holzminden, he was back to the muck and the risk. And the farther they bored their hole, the more muck and the more risk the tunnelers had to endure. By early April, the tunnel was almost 10 yards longer than the one at Neunkirchen had been, and it felt even longer given the bends and pitches on the 20-minute crawl to its end. Finally, Blaine arrived at the tunnel face. Today he was the number one man in the shift, the digger. Slowly, but with a certain rhythm, he hacked with a makeshift chisel at the wall ahead, scraped away the loose chunks with a trowel, then filled the bowl with the excavated earth using a small hand rake. Even though he had vowed never to sap again, there was a part of him that enjoyed it. The danger, the toil, the teamwork. It was an adventure, and a better way to spend his days than sitting in the barracks, as long as the candle wedged into the wall by his side continued to flicker and dance. If the flame dulled into a faint red, he was in trouble. Back by the tunnel entrance, Gray was keeping the candle, and Blaine, alive. The number two man, the pumper, he crouched in a small cave carved into an early left turn in the sap. There, he operated what might best be described as a bellows. As the tunnel lengthened past the sandstone wall, the diggers found that they began to grow faint from lack of oxygen. A few grew delirious and had to be dragged out by their feet. Some method to supply fresh air was needed. Gray and the others crafted a makeshift bellows out of wooden planks and a leather RFC jacket set on a vertical stand. To pipe the air to the tunnel face, they collected round shaving tins, knocked out the ends, strung them together, and covered them with canvas. Links were added to its end when needed. Being the pumper was monotonous, arduous work. As Gray heaved in and out on the arms of the bellows, the sound the machine produced matched the pace of his own breath. Kennard stood just a few feet away inside the chamber underneath the staircase. He held a rope in his hand and waited to feel its tug. The number three man in the shift, the packer, he was responsible for hauling the bowl of dirt and stone when Blaine was ready to send it back. He emptied its contents into cloth sacks and stacked them in the steadily shrinking space in the chamber. On a good, well-run shift, the digger would have another pile to put in the bowl by the time the packer was ready to have him pull it back. During each 4-hour shift, Blaine, Gray, and Kennard rotated through the jobs. Being the digger for too long was simply not sustainable, particularly for the claustrophobic Kennard, who had to summon every shred of will to maintain his calm. The exertion, the foul air, the press of earth in every direction, the threat of collapse, all took their toll. To exit the tunnel, the digger had to snake backward, feet first, inch by inch, to reach the opening. There was simply no space in which to turn around. At 3:45 p.m., the shift was over. The three men shed their grungy work outfits, wiped their skin clear of dirt, and redonned their orderly uniforms. Now they had to sneak back to their quarters. First, they had to wait for the all-clear. At this late afternoon hour, guards often used the stairs, either to bring up supplies from the cellars or to deposit them there. Through the thin breaks in the plank wall, the tunnelers could see them pass. Finally, an orderly rapped on the secret door to the chamber, then announced, "Come out now." The three men unlatched the slide bolt and stepped out through the plank door. At first, the light stung their eyes. Then they hurried up the steps as the orderly returned the bolt into place. At the exit, they waited for one of their lookouts to give them another all clear. With a single word, "Right," the three moved out, forcing themselves not to so much as glance at the guard opposite the door. If he got a look at their faces, he might recognize one of them as an officer. Onward they continued, to the right, trying not to walk too fast or too slow. They were famished, exhausted, and suffering stabbing headaches from the terrible air and the slowing of adrenaline. They relied on others from their team to intercept and distract any Germans who might be crossing their path from the cookhouse or elsewhere. At last, they were back in room 24, where they quickly changed back into their officer uniforms. Chapter 16. Whether they were walking the yard, sitting in their rooms, or working their shifts, the tunnelers continually hashed out how, once through the sap, they would make it 150 miles to the border. The distance they would have to travel as fugitives would be far greater given the detours and circuitous route needed to avoid towns, major roads, and other areas. Gray was particularly aware that most escapes fell apart in this phase. Day and night, he considered different plans, searching for something foolproof. Most of the tunnelers were banding up in teams for the flight to Holland, and Gray was committed to going with Blaine and Kennard. He would not do a solitary run again. His own had proved how important it was to have partners who would look out for each other. There were few braver, tougher, and more cool-headed when it mattered than Blaine and Kennard. Travel by train, Gray discounted, chiefly because a mass breakout would surely result in Niemeyer dispatching police or soldiers to every nearby station and alerting conductors to confront any suspicious passengers. This left a journey by foot. Moving at night and hiding out during the day limited their chances of discovery. But Gray also knew that there was almost no way to cover such a distance without being spotted and forced into some kind of interaction. They would need disguises and cover stories. In previous attempts, he and his fellow breakout artists had pretended to be civilians or soldiers. But disguises and forged papers only went so far in an escape effort. If questioned while in enemy territory, they would need to respond in flawless German and have a legitimate reason for being in the area. Gray spoke German fluently, but Blaine and Kennard lacked proficiency. Blaine knew Cape Dutch from his time in South Africa, and could make a decent attempt at answering simple questions in German, but Kennard was unable to manage more than a few prepared phrases. Knowing this, Gray considered a plan, where he would be in the position of speaking for both men. He would act as an officer, escorting a pair of privates. However, that plan did not eliminate the possibility that Blaine and Kennard would be required to speak if addressed directly by a German officer. Further, the uniforms the escapees would be wearing in disguise would never remain sufficiently clean to pass for military inspection after they had tramped through woods and slept out of doors. No, Gray decided. The three needed a plan that was sure to convince any doubters. Something fail-safe. There was a lot the tunnelers needed to do in preparation. They needed good maps and compasses, as well as food for 15 days of travel, and Tommy cookers to heat meals. They needed warm clothes and durable boots. They needed waterproof sacks to get their belongings across the River Weser. There were documents to forge, clothes to tailor, photographs to take. In the unoccupied room 83, the tunnelers assembled a veritable escape factory, or, as they called it, a temple to the goddess of flight. They hid items under the floorboards and behind sliding paneled walls, along with all manner of equipment used in their preparations, including locksmithing and woodworking tools, a sewing machine, and dyes, inks, and paper for passes. They had built their tunnel bellows in this room. By mid-April, they were hard at work making passes and creating backpacks from old jackets smeared with lard. In all these efforts, they had help. Since first arriving at Holzminden, Gray and the others had bribed and inveigled some of the guards and other Holzminden staff, turning them into willing accomplices who provided information or special items. Their poor treatment by Niemeyer made them easy turncoats. As one British officer described, when the commandant tired of abusing his prisoners, he vented his black gusts of bilious passion at his staff, often leaving them literally trembling as he flayed them with his tongue. The war's harsh economic rationing was added motivation. Letter Boy, the commandant's clerk, was easily charmed with coffee and cookies. His work delivering mail gave him free rein to move about the barracks, and he met almost daily with the conspirators to pass along the latest intelligence or material he purchased on their behalf. What was more, he always knew when searches were coming and where they would occur. The sanitary man was the only civilian at Holzminden who could go about without a guard accompanying him. In exchange for some cash and something from Fortnum & Mason, the upmarket London grocery store, he would shop in town for any goods the prisoners requested. The typist, a young secretary in the Kommandantur, helped them for less mercenary reasons. She had fallen in love with Peter Lyon, a 6'3" Australian infantry officer who was a member of the backup working party. Since his capture in spring 1917, Lyon had lost over 60 pounds due to an insufficient diet, but he had retained his good looks. While exchanging love notes with Lyon, the typist provided sample passes and the paper stock on which they were printed. Finally, there was Kurt Grau, a well-meaning camp interpreter. He had been stationed in India, and once proclaimed, "I do not care for Germany. I do not care for England. My heart is in India." As Gray had served a number of years in the army there, not to mention it being his birthplace, he was able to convince Grau that he could help set him up in India once the war was over. Grau became a friend to their cause. The tunnelers benefited as well from their continued alliance with several orderlies. Beyond providing access to their quarters, these men were also helping with the escape factory. With his photography experience, Dick Cash was foremost among them. Not only did the officers need photographs for their passes, each needed a copy of a map for his journey. It was one thing to chart a general westward course, and quite another to have a map on hand to identify every village, road, waterway, and town they came across. The ability to do so might mean the difference between success and recapture. They had managed to smuggle into Holzminden a large military map that covered the expanse of territory they would cross, from which copies were to be made. Cash made a shopping list. Camera, plates, chemicals, printer paper, and a carbide bike lamp to develop the film. With the officers, he started collecting what he needed. Each week, Gray asked for additional copies of the map, because as the sap lengthened, the number of officers brought into the fold increased. Two of them, John Tullis and Stanley Purves, were Gray's roommates and provided cover for him during his frequent disappearances into the tunnel. Edward Leggett, Blaine's former escape partner from Clausthal, who had recently arrived at the camp, was also included. On his emergence from solitary, Charles Rathbone became the senior British officer at Holzminden. Protocol required he be informed of the plan, and Gray also knew the lieutenant colonel was keen to mount his own escape and could stall other attempts that might result in their tunnel's discovery. When notified, Rathbone not only gave his blessing, but volunteered to join the scheme and help in any way he could. Thanks in part to his relationship with the typist, Lyon had been welcomed into the group, along with RFC observer John Bousfield. Others were brought in to stand lookout as well as to obtain boards to brace the tunnel walls, sacks to pack dirt into, and tins to extend the ventilation pipe. With each additional member, the chance of exposure grew, but Gray accepted the risk. There was no other way to build a tunnel of such length, and to orchestrate a well-prepared, properly supplied home run to Holland. One afternoon, Gray finally struck on an idea of how to execute his own escape run with Blaine and Kennard. He was in the tunnel chamber with the two of them, preparing to start their shift. Kennard lit a candle and kneeled down by the sap entrance. Looking into the dark hole, he muttered, "We must be bloody mad." In that moment, Gray had his inspiration. "That's it!" he exclaimed. Blaine and Kennard looked at their usually taciturn friend, as if he had suddenly lost himself. "Mad!" Gray chuckled. "Mad, that's the answer. It simply couldn't miss." The two tried to get him to explain, but he said he wanted to think on it some more to investigate its faults and merits. "Come on, let's get on with it," he said, taking the candle from Kennard. "I think I've come up with the answer to our prayers, that's all." With that, he crawled into the tunnel, the first digger of the day. In early May, Jim Bennett was hacking away at a section of earth. He lifted up slightly on his knees and elbows to bring a pillowcase filled with his shift's diggings up alongside his body. Every additional foot of tunnel seemed to bring another obstacle. In an earlier shift, he had misread the compass they used to keep on a straight line, and the sap took an unnecessary twist that had to be course-corrected. Water was beginning to seep into the tunnel. Not enough to require channeling it out, but the walls were collapsing in parts, and a half-buried tunneler had to be dragged loose by his feet. Then there was the difficulty of hauling out the excavated dirt and stone. The relay system with the basin and rope became impossible. The rope got abraded on rocks and kept snapping, and the basin upended on the sap's many twists and turns. Now the digger filled a sack at the tunnel face and dragged it out with him. Already exhausted and anxious for some fresh air, Bennett began his long journey back in the half-darkness. He squirmed a few inches backward, set his candle down by his chin, then pulled the cumbersome pillowcase of dirt and stone after him. Squirm, set candle, pull. Squirm, set candle, pull. He had to make sure not to knock down any of the braces, nor to disturb the tin can snake that provided precious oxygen to the tunnel, nor to snuff out the light that kept any grip on sanity possible. A half hour, more, passed before he finally reached the chamber under the stairs. Despite all the challenges, the tunnel now measured roughly 40 yards. They were almost underneath the farmland adjacent to the prison. 20 more yards of digging, and they would reach the rye field where they intended to exit. The tall rye would provide cover from the guard stationed outside the fence on the night of the escape. Bennett's kit was almost ready. Every week, more parcels came from his mother and his erstwhile partner, Roy Fitzgerald. He was as fit as could be expected. The tunnel was hard work, but it kept him active. So, too, did the soccer matches Niemeyer now allowed on the Spielplatz. Finally, Niemeyer had relented on the onerous demands Hainisch had placed on allowing parole walks outside the walls. These strolls gave them some insight into the hillsides and the breadth of the river Weser, which they would have to cross on their first night out. Although Holzminden was becoming overcrowded with the deluge of prisoners from the now stalled March offense, life there had reached a kind of equilibrium. Niemeyer still ranted and raved, charged outrageous prices at the canteen, and sentenced men to solitary confinement for the slightest offense. The prisoners struck back in their own ways. They charmed Niemeyer's precious dog with treats, sending the commandant into paroxysms of rage when his hound would not go to him when called. They refused to frequent the canteen until prices were lowered. They held parties, concerts, and theater productions in the barracks as if they had not a care in the world. As Bennett wrote his mother, "I am in very good health and quite fit to put up with any bad times the Germans take it up in their heads to give us." Despite this conviction, he was eager as ever to be free, and certain that he soon would be, thanks to the tunnel. Then a run of bad luck and imprudence put everything in jeopardy. First, rumors of the scheme began to filter throughout the camp. with roughly 24 individuals in the know, and the strange movements of officers in and out of their quarters, keeping their activities secret was unlikely. But it was one thing to hear a rumor, and another thing altogether to receive useful intelligence on the tunnel plot. Then an orderly known to spy for Niemeyer in exchange for gifts of wine began asking around camp about where the tunnel's entrance was hidden. Betrayal was too great to risk for the tunnelers, and one night, while drunk, the orderly accidentally tumbled down the steps in Block B and cracked his skull. He never made another inquiry. This risk averted, a greater one followed. In mid-May, on orders from Hainisch, Niemeyer instituted camp-wide reprisal measures in response to those put in place against German officers in Britain. Parole walks were suspended. All theater productions, concerts, and outdoor games were canceled. Worst of all for the tunnelers, a new schedule of roll calls began. Instead of twice a day at 9 a.m. and 4 p.m., the prisoners were now forced to gather on the Spielplatz at 9 a.m., 11:30 a.m., 3:30 p.m., and 6 p.m. These frequent assemblies cut straight into the middle of the four-hour tunnel shifts. The tunnelers tried standing in for those on shift. When the names of the working crew were called, their mates answered for them, then moved down the line to respond to their own names. They pulled it off for a few days, but were sure that continuing the charade day after day would surely see them caught. Instead, they began to rush to and from their digging sessions between the 11:30 and 3:30 roll calls, the only time of the day when most guards were away from Block B due to lunch. Roll calls took at least a half hour, and even hurrying, the teams of three had less than 2 hours underground. Their recklessness quickly cost them. One day, after finishing a shift, a working party was rushing out of the east door of Block B without taking the usual precautions, and one of the officers was recognized by a passing guard. The guard tried to stop him, but the officer fled into the barracks through his own entrance. Niemeyer was informed of the incident, and a search of Block B followed, but the guard could not identify the specific officer. Niemeyer ordered all prisoners onto the Spielplatz. An exhaustive inspection of the orderlies' barracks began. The tunnelers waited for the fateful moment when their secret door would be found. They imagined Niemeyer parading out of the barracks, a victorious grin on his face showing his delight at foiling another escape. Interrogations and punishments were sure to follow. After a long time, the prisoners were ordered back into their barracks. Once again, the secret door had eluded discovery. The tunnelers breathed easy at last. Incensed that nothing had been found, Niemeyer vented his spleen on the guard, who had failed to identify the officer in the orderly uniform by sending him to solitary for 8 days. He also closed off the attic floor in Block B's officer section and posted a permanent guard on the steps outside the orderly's door to check anyone who went in or came out. With this, the tunnelers lost their access point. It was a devastating blow. The POW camp at Bad Kolberg was almost 200 miles due south of Holzminden. It was housed in a former sanatorium famous for its thermal springs. Will Harvey could not have asked for better surroundings. A villa, a nice room, open windows, tennis courts, pine-covered hillsides with wildflowers and butterflies to enjoy on walks. Freshly shaven and looking years younger than he had the previous dark winter, he could almost forgive the camp commandant, a stubborn, dim-witted fool called Kroner, and his adjutant, Captain Bates, to whom he gave a free hand for spoiling the whole atmosphere. Harvey had suffered from some ill-tempered jailers over the course of his long captivity, and he considered Bates the worst man in Germany. In the past, under such a hard regime, Harvey would have retreated into himself, but Holzminden had changed him. He labored over his poetry, and he gave lectures, including one on the causes and effects of, and remedies to, war, in which he argued, "What, when all is said and done, is war but that same old savage, stupid mode of settling differences, which was abolished and replaced by law in the case of the individual?" Harvey also made it his duty to resist oppression at every turn. One day, in early May, guards stopped an attempt to cut through the wire fence. In their